Next presenter is Sebastian Wetzelmeyer.
Thank you, Alexandra, for inviting me to present our results on soil sea stock reporting, and I'll take examples from Belgium. So maybe there are two handicaps. I'm not a real statistician, and I'm reporting from Belgium, which you might even not know where it is, but I hope you can bear with me. Our work is in the framework of CO2 fluxes from the soil to the atmosphere, and the approach we're using is sort of to detect changes in the soil carbon stock. And as you can see on the central photo, the variability of these carbon stocks is already large, both in sort of spatial extent and also in depth. And the sampling is hard work, so that you can only sort of do it once in every 10 years. And then you get sort of long-term carbon changes, as opposed to sort of other methods, sort of direct methods with flux chambers or the eddy covariance towers, which give short-term fluxes but sort of do not account for the spatial variation. And recently there are a number of papers, amongst others by CA et al., who try to combine these different techniques, and the results do not seem to match up for the moment, which is sort of slightly worrying. So I'm going to look at sort of the problems you might encounter in determining soil carbon stocks, and I'll discuss first sort of the traditional way of determining these, which is taking samples and analyzing the carbon in the laboratory, and then sort of discuss some possibilities for proximal sensing techniques, combining visible and near infrared spectroscopy for carbon content, seismic surveys for soil depths, and electrical resistivity for bulk density, and see if these approaches can overcome the problems with the statistical problems and the variation, coping with the large spatial variation. So the parameters I'm going to use are the size of uncertainties. And to deal with sort of the size of uncertainties, we have replicated our survey at different scales. For the uncertainty in laboratory results, we treated the samples more than once in the same laboratory, but sort of replicate samples. For the micro site, we had sort of samples in over a small area, which we analyzed separately. For the field sites, we had sort of two campaigns. One original campaign, where the surveyor had information on the sites to be sampled, found the sites, checked for the topography, and the soil were the same as they were in the descriptions, marked the sites. And then a year later, another surveyor was given the same information and went to the same sites located himself and sort of measured the difference in distance from what he found and what the first surveyor found. And then sort of we used the landscape scale, and we defined it as a stratification according to land use, soil type, and agroclimatic region, which gives sort of polygons and for which a number of samples are representative. So that's the replication. And then we did this for two types of land use, cropland and grassland, and for stony soils and non-stony soils. The non-stony soils are in the northern part of Wallonia, it's the southern part of Belgium, and the stony soils are in the southern part. Sort of, in contrast with the previous speaker, the scale of this map, Belgium is only a small country, it's 200 kilometers wide, and sort of north-south, it's 120, this map. So, and then as a parameter, we use the root mean square error. So that was for the size of the uncertainties. The source of the uncertainties, we looked at the standard deviation of the source stock, and the source stock is defined, as you can see in the equation. We use sort of a soil stock till a specified soil depth, accounting for the bulk density and the stone content. And then we use the error propagation method to infer the influence of the different factors in the soil stock on the end result. So as you can see here, the variance in the soil stock is a linear function of the variances in the carbon content, the bulk density, and the soil depths, and the stone content, and the covariances between these parameters. So, as it is a linear function, we can see what the contribution of each of these variables is in the end result. Okay, so that's the approach. So, we're looking at the size and the sources of uncertainty. I'll quickly show you sort of the sampling framework. It is it's stratified, as I said, we stratified according to land use, climate, region, and soil type. And then sort of we resampled sites that were originally sampled in 1955, and we selected randomly 430 of these locations. So these are the sites I'm going to talk about. Here you can see sort of the approaches you have to take when you sample sites. You need to be careful that you're sort of at the right position that you want to describe. You need to sample till a specified depth, sort of, and sort of take the plow horizon as a first sample, and then underneath until 30 centimeters another sample. Take care to take bulk density samples, and we also marked the sites with a magnetic marker in order to be able to repeat the sampling in 10 years' time, which will be more or less 2 or 3 years now. And then sort of we use these variables to calculate the soil, the SOC stock, soil organic carbon stock. So coming sort of to the results of this resampling campaign. At the field scale, as I already told you, we had sort of one surveyor sort of doing a first survey, marking the sites, and then a second surveyor. We gave him the same information, the same coordinates, a description of the topography and a description of the soil. He looked for what he thought was the site and sampled that site. And like that, we had about sort of 80 replicates in grasslands and in croplands. And as the first surveyor had marked the site, the second one was able to measure the distance between what he thought was the correct site and what the first surveyor thought was the correct site. And you can see that it was about 7 meters in croplands and 10 meters in grasslands. So if you send two groups with sort of with not sort of very precise GPS coordinates, then you will have a difference in distance on average between 7 and 10 meters. And that resulted in, when we plotted sort of the results of the first survey against the second survey, you can calculate a root mean square error of 5 tons per hectare in cropland and 18 tons per hectare in grasslands. At the landscape scale, you integrate the results of more or less 20 to 40 individual fields into one unit, and then the mean of the landscape unit, the root mean square error becomes less. This already demonstrates sort of the first the problem in these surveys is that they are generally easier to do at sort of the larger areas for regions than they are to do for fields. And this, in this case, we calculated everything in equivalent mass. If we didn't calculate in equivalent mass, then the errors became even larger. So what does this imply if we want to calculate carbon stocks for larger areas, for reporting for the region or for a country? First of all, if we take this land use, in that case, if we take this landscape unit approach, we assume that the carbon stock in the landscape unit is uniform, is the same, and we give it a mean and we have a standard deviation. As you see on the map, we can't sample all these landscape units because there are some that are sort of too small and it will take too much work to sample all of them. We only sample the larger ones in practice, and then you get taking into account the number of samples and the standard deviation, you can detect changes of more or less 20% of the carbon stock, because that's the more or less the impact of the spatial variability within your units. Another way of treating this problem is sort of using multiple regression models. In that way, you can sort of produce a map of the whole region and sort of for each pixel attribute the soil carbon stock. The white ones are the gray ones are towns, and the white ones are under forest. This is only agricultural land use. So for each pixel you can calculate the carbon stock, but the R square between observed and predicted is generally using these models not extremely high. It's about 0.7. And as we can see in this table, these different approaches for regionalization, either by landscape unit or by multiple regression models, or there are also some examples where they applied soil organic matter dynamic models like Century or DNDC, they give sort of root mean square errors for each site that has been sampled that are still quite high, from 30 to 60%. For the model approaches, especially the initialization is a big problem. And you can also see that sort of the number of samples varies dramatically between these surveys. And maybe the approaches, the resampling approaches, they still give reasonable root mean square errors with a limited number of samples. So if I come now to the sources of the uncertainty, calculated with this error propagation method from the standard deviation. First of all, here you see the different scales. The sample, microsite, field, and the landscape, which were replicated. And in the top, you see the standard deviation between of these samples. First of all, in the cropland, you see that the standard deviation does not, well, it increases, but it does not increase dramatically if you go from the sample to the landscape scale. For croplands, for grasslands, the increase is much bigger. And then in the colors in the graph, you can see the importance of the different factors contributing to this variation. And in most of the cases, it's the blue, that's the variation in solid organic carbon content. That sort of is the determining factor that explains most of the variation, apart for the field scale, where the bulk density in croplands plays an important role, even more important than the variation in soil organic carbon content, and the depth of the first layer in the grasslands. In these sort of, in general, in the literature, not enough is taking into account the covariance, because these variables are all correlated. For instance, the bulk density and the carbon content are correlated, and so there are also covariances to be taken into account. And if you take them into account, they reduce the variability. Here are some sort of, I zoom in to all of these scales. The microsite, here you see sort of a drawing of the microsite in the bottom. This is the marker, and here are all the samples taken, and the crosses are sort of for future sampling. The variability is caused by sort of variation in carbon content, and sort of what you can do to reduce this variability is taking composite samples, taking more samples and analyzing a composite sample. At the field scale, you see that sort of the standard deviation is quite high. I have to admit that in this replicate sampling, we only sort of had two samples in each field, one replicate sample, so the standard deviation might be a bit overestimated, but still sort of there is a quite large spatial variability. And if you want to reduce the effect of spatial variability, it's mainly due to the bulk density in the croplands and the thickness of the first horizon in the grasslands. So precise sampling, precise georeferencing of the points, and resampling on as much as possible the same point will reduce this source of variability. At the landscape scale, the variability is due mainly to the carbon content. So for regional studies, we might even consider sort of taking Peter transfer functions for bulk density. That might not compromise too much the uncertainty. And reducing this spatial variability can be dealt with by increasing the sample number. I've shown that sort of the field scale still remains, the variability of carbon stock in at the field scale still remains a large problem, especially sort of in Belgium, where fields are more or less 5 hectares and not bigger. It's difficult to convince farmers or decision makers to sample fields at densities of more than 100 samples per field. So we have tested different techniques to obtain a higher sample density. And one of these techniques is sort of the proximal sensing techniques, of which this is an example of an EU project, the DigiSoil project that has just finished. And in this project, we tried different geophysical techniques in the blue boxes on the left, in order to predict through inversion different soil properties on the right. And some of these soil properties, such as the carbon stock, are a combination of different techniques. Obviously, this comes at a cost, because even one sort of single geophysical signal, translating it to a soil property, increases the uncertainty, and if you combine more than one, then you're in trouble. So I'll quickly show you the test we did on a field site in Luxembourg. It was a site with sort of a maximal amount of trouble, if I can say so. It was thin soils, stony, and the carbon content, as you see, sort of in the soil profiles, varied also quite sharply within the field. But it was chosen on purpose in order that everybody could test their technique and have sort of a variation in the results. Here you see sort of the way we used to calibrate and validate the geophysical techniques, taking soil cores and then analyzing the rock fragment, the stone content, the bulk density, the soil organic carbon content, and the texture. And these are some box and whisker plots of the distribution of the of these parameters, the stone content increasing with soil depths, the bulk density also increasing with soil depths, and soil organic carbon content decreasing with soil depths. So for the first 20 centimeters, I'll show you the results first, where we combine sort of hyperspectral techniques to determine soil organic carbon content and geoelectric techniques to determine rock fragment content and bulk density. So this is a map of the soil organic carbon content determined with visible and near infrared reflectance spectroscopy from an airborne platform. And in the graph on the right, bottom right, you can see the prediction and the observation of the validation points. And the root mean square error of this technique is around 3 grams per kilogram, or 0.3% of carbon, which is not too bad to compare to laboratory analysis. For the electrical resistivity tomography, it was a team of the INRA in Orléans who did it, so I don't know the results. I don't know the exact procedure, but they sort of made maps of the resistivity for the whole field. And from these maps, they constructed maps for the stone content and for the bulk density. And then we were able, we can then sort of overlay the soil organic carbon content map, the bulk density map, and the stone content map, and produce a map of SOC stocks. Again, in the top right, you see the observed predicted, and we get sort of a root mean square errors of 9 tons per hectare. Yeah, that seems a lot. It's also some of the errors are some of the points, like this one. Here you see these are the residuals. These points are here. They sort of are poorly predicted, and they sort of influence the results a lot. So, and they are mainly due to a problem in the estimation of the stone content. So, if these points would have been better predicted, the results would have been better. Yeah, so this was for the top 20 centimeter. Now you can also include seismic profiling, where sort of the velocity of the P waves is mapped, as you can see here, and validated against penetrometer resistance, where a sharp break in penetrometer resistance indicates the bedrock, and then create a map of the total soil thickness. And if you combine that with sort of the interpolations of these soil properties derived from the calibration and the validation points, you can produce sort of maps again for the soil stock of the whole field. So Yeah, for the moment, that's what we did until now. We looked at sort of the spatial dependence of these stock maps. You can see that they're quite nice semivariograms that can be constructed, and we can use these semivariograms to predict what they call the model mean. So that would be sort of the mean plus or minus the confidence limit of the solar organic carbon stock of similar fields in the region. But obviously that's not sort of what we're interested in. We're interested in more, this is my one slide. So we're interested in the solar organic carbon stock of the field and its confidence limit. So that one we still have to work out. So in conclusion, I hope I've demonstrated that sort of sources of uncertainty can be quite large. If normally we would do a survey and then sort of report the results, but if you repeat the survey, you see that you can have sort of large uncertainties. That sort of the root mean square error from sort of precision of sampling can reach 14 to 31%, which is quite high. The sources of variability can be identified with the error propagation method, and they're sort of the main factor of variability is the carbon concentration. Apart from the field scale, where the bulk density for croplands played an important role, and the thickness of the first horizon for grasslands. Furthermore, covariances should not be neglected because they reduce the variability, in our case at least. Then sort of the proximal sensing methods. They have the advantage that they provide an enormous amount of data. In our field of 5 hectares, we had 1,692 pixels. There's a strong spatial correlation. So we can't use all of them in order to calculate the mean values. Root mean square errors you can find here. They're logically a bit higher than using traditional techniques, and they work out as a root mean square error in a sock stock of around 10 tons per hectare. These are the results that we get for the sock stock at 20 and for the full soil profile. So, what is still in progress is taking into account these the errors in the proximal sensing techniques and coming up with a sock stock for the field plus or minus a confidence limit. Thank you. Croplands. I suppose it's because we didn't take into account a fixed depth of 30 centimeters, but we estimated it for the thickness of the A horizon, and it can vary a lot in grasslands.
Oh, okay.
If I would have used a fixed depth, Then sort of the depth wouldn't have entered in any of the equations, actually.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Questions? I have a question. I have to use the microphone because no one hears me when I don't use it. I have a question on those permanent markers that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Could you tell a little bit more how does that work, what it is?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if you use permanent markers, always ask permission of the farmers, because we ran into enormous troubles because the farmer, he had problems with his cattle, and he had several cows dying, and he thought it was because of our markers. So that's and it was it went up to court and everything. But these permanent markers, they are from 3M, the company that makes post-its and everything. And they are sort of simple, they're antennas, wired antennas, floating in a bit of antifreeze so that it always points up. And you can detect them with an emitter of a signal. They're used in construction a lot in order that sort of, that during roadworks people don't dig up cables, because you can find the cable before you dig it up. That's the idea. And these markers, yeah, and nowadays the GPSs are also very precise, but these ones give you sort of centimeter precision.
Okay, if there is no more question.
Thank you.